The headlines: the Pentagon denies that a 2019 airstrike in Syria that killed many civilians was a war crime, saying no violation of the law of war occurred. Pro-Palestine activists mark the 74th anniversary of Nakba Day in several Latin American countries, holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And Iran foreign ministry says in NATO's eastward expansion and the West's disregard for Russia's security are to blame for the war in Ukraine. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shah Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The U.S. Department of Defense says an investigation into the 2019 strike by American forces in Syria that reportedly killed many civilians has found no policy violations for, quote, wanted negligence. The probe focused on an airstrike by the U.S. forces on the Daesh bastion in Syria. The investigation was launched last year after the New York Times reported the U.S. military had covered up dozens of non-combatant deaths. The Times report says 70 people, of whom women and children, had been killed. A U.S. Army investigation, however, rejects that conclusion. The Times report also says that it calls administrative defenses delayed the U.S. military reports on the strike, giving the impression that it was being covered up. The Pentagon probe claims no, quote, disregard of civilian casualties occurred, plus it puts the number of civilian fatalities at only 4. Activists in Latin American countries hold events to mark the 74th anniversary of Palestine's Nakba Day, or the Day of Catastrophe. People in Peru, Panama, Chile, Argentina held rallies and marches in solidarity with the people of Palestine. The Venezuelan capital Caracas paid tribute to slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh by projecting her photo on the building of the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development. The Al Jazeera reporter was fatally shot by Israeli troops last week while covering a raid on the Palestinian city of Jenin. Abu Akleh's death touched off international condemnation of Tel Aviv's regime and its violence. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says NATO's eastward expansion and the West's disregard for Russian security concerns are to blame for the war in Ukraine. Said Khatibzadeh said NATO must realize that the confrontation does not have a happy ending. He also criticized the failure of the West to abide by the agreements that it struck with Russia. Moscow launched a war on Ukraine on February 24th, citing Kiev's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreement, first signed in 2014. Russia also pointed to security threats posed by NATO's eastward expansion and demanded guarantees that Kiev would never join the U.S. military bloc. NATO, however, rejected the request. Sweden and Finland are the latest in a bid to join NATO, despite warnings from Moscow. The Russian president criticizes European countries for imposing more sanctions on Moscow under U.S. pressure, despite the adverse impact of those bans on their own economies.
Today, we see that for absolutely politically charged reasons, because of their own ambitions and under pressure from their American overlord, European countries are imposing more and more new sanctions on the oil and gas markets. All this leads to inflation, and instead of admitting their mistakes, they look for the guilty party elsewhere.
Putin noted that Western sanctions and a possible EU embargo on Russian oil have pushed global prices up. He said such measures have already stoked inflation across Europe. Putin made the remarks during a televised meeting with a group of domestic oil managers and government officials. He said it is impossible for some European countries to completely shun Russian oil imports for now.
The Europeans openly admit that they cannot yet completely abandon Russian energy resources. Moreover, it's obvious that some EU states, in whose energy balance the share of Russian hydrocarbons is especially high, will not be able to do this for quite some time.
The Russian president also underscored the need for creating appropriate conditions for Russia's domestic oil producers in the face of sanctions. He pledged help for those companies, including facilitating access to loans, insurance, and Brussels had already imposed 5 rounds of sanctions targeting Russia's key sectors, entities, and individuals over the war with Ukraine. EU members are now negotiating a proposed oil embargo on Russia as part of the bloc's 6th package of bans. However, the latest round of their talks failed this week due to a veto by Hungary, which is heavily dependent on Russian oil. The cost of living crisis in the UK is worsening, and with it, the health of the British public. A new survey of more than 2,000 Britons has found that the pressure from the rising energy bills and other expenses is pushing many British households to the brink. Saeed Pureza reports.
As they go about their day, millions of Britons are consumed with one big question: how to make ends meet in the year ahead as the impact of the cost of living crisis kicks in.
It brings a lot of frustration because we know that energy companies, like very recently BP and other companies, are posting the highest ever profits. So it almost feels really unfair. And definitely it's going to have an impact on some families.
I can't even save in. Now you've got to allocate that money for other places, you know, for feeding your family, your kids. Everything's gone up. Petrol's gone up. So houses now, you might have to put that in a back burner or wait a bit until things better.
The cost of living crisis has barely begun, but the alarm bells are already ringing.
The numbers are pretty stark. Inflation is at a 30-year high. Thousands of people could face eviction as that inflation could feed through into the housing market. More than 5 million Britons already have to choose between food and heating, as the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey warns of apocalyptic food prices in the months ahead.
Not everyone is impacted. Bearing the brunt, low-income households, not only on their finances, but also on their health. The stress from soaring energy and food costs is preventing 1 in 2 people in Britain from looking after their well-being, with some even not affording to travel to hospital.
I can't sleep at night. Last night I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I've been up since then because of these prices. It's just, you know, what can you do?
The culprit for all this, a cocktail of Brexit, the pandemic, and the Russian military conflict in Ukraine. Britain was one of the first countries banning Russian energy imports. The impact of that decision now felt by the people here.
The government really needs to look into this thoroughly, how they can help people out there to find a job. People that have lost their businesses along the line, they need to look into that as well, how to maybe they need to sustain them, provide funding.
The UK government says it's providing support worth over $24 billion within the next year to help families with the pressures from the increasing cost of living. The big question is, will it work? Saeed Pureza, London.
Protesters gather outside the United Kingdom's Home Office to call on the government to block the extradition order of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to the United States. Some 200 demonstrators staged a rally in London. Assange's wife says that his lawyers have submitted arguments that would help overrule the UK court order. It is now up to the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, whether to extradite to the Australian whistleblower, although Assange's legal team will have 2 weeks to appeal a possible go-ahead. Assange is wanted in the United States for 18 criminal charges related to the release by the WikiLeaks of about 500,000 classified U.S. military records. If extradited, he could face life in prison. The UK announces plans to alter the terms of the post-Brexit trade deal for Northern Ireland, despite EU warnings against any unilateral action.
I am announcing our intention to introduce legislation in the coming weeks to make changes in the protocol. Our preference remains a negotiated solution with the EU. And in parallel with the legislation being introduced, we remain open to further talks if we can achieve the same outcome through negotiated settlement.
The UK Foreign Secretary said a bill would be introduced in Parliament in the coming weeks to make changes to the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol, but she added that a legislative solution is not about scrapping the protocol and will remain in consistency with Britain's obligations under international law. The Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the UK's divorce deal with the EU. It effectively created a customs border in the area between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK to prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland. The EU says that any unilateral UK action on the protocol represents a clear breach of international law. It was warned that it will respond with all measures as a disposal goes ahead with the alteration.
It was supposed to ensure seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island. The most recent reason, the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party, Sinn Féin, came top for the first time ever. The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who wanted to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy and the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
This is the Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of a post-Brexit withdrawal agreement aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The Unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it, but to the EU, that is anathema.
The Unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place.
Boris Johnson clearly wanted to get Brexit done. And so he promised just about anything to the Unionists to get them to agree. At the same time, the Unionists had a vested interest in staying good friends with the British, the Westminster government, because a rift with them would be very damaging for the Unionist cause. Now they've got to live with those consequences.
It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government, led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the Unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and Unionists in Northern Ireland, and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
The North Korean leader criticizes the officials' handling of the fever outbreak in the country. Speaking at a party meeting, Kim Jong-un said immaturity in the state's capacity to respond to the outbreak has exacerbated the crisis. North Korea has reported over 1.7 million cases with fever symptoms, as well as more than 60 deaths. While North Korea reported its first COVID infection last week, it has yet to reveal how many people have tested positive for the coronavirus. The country's leader has already branded the outbreak the biggest turmoil the republic has experienced since its foundation. The UN envoy for Yemen calls for extending a long-sought truce in the country, which will expire in 2 weeks. He said that the ceasefire has significantly reduced violence in Yemen and helped improve the living conditions. The two-month UN-brokered truce went into effect in early April. Speaking at the end of a closed UN Security Council meeting, the envoy said that there have been no aerial attacks from Yemen and no confirmed airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition. He also said that more needed to be done to contain the crisis in Yemen as part of the truce. The first commercial flight in nearly 6 years left Yemen's capital on Monday. He also said that another flight was scheduled for Wednesday. Official results from Lebanon's parliamentary elections show independent candidates have made unprecedented gains in Sunday's polls. According to the Interior Ministry, independent candidates won at least 13 seats in the 128-member assembly. They campaigned against Lebanon's ruling elite and vowed to bring about reforms. The resistance movement Hezbollah and its allies won 62 seats but lost their majority. Hezbollah opponents, including the Saudi-aligned Lebanese forces, a Christian faction, gained ground. The results leave parliament split into several camps, with none of them having an absolute majority. This raises the prospects of political paralysis and tensions that could delay reforms needed to steer the country out of its devastating economic crisis. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines for political activities of armed forces and said that he strongly warned these forces against involvement in political activities and membership in any political party or group due to the fact that it would undermine armed forces and ultimately harm the power of the country and the system. This week, we are going to discuss the situation of cinema in the pre-Islamic revolution era and touch upon Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Cinema is a very important domain in culture and art of every country. Cinema entered Iran during the rule of King Muzaffaruddin of Qajar dynasty in 1890s. This art was not welcomed by ulema and religious strata due to its corrupt nature and the fact that it spread the European lifestyle. During the rule of Reza Khan in early 20th century, cinema found its way to other a few cities in addition to the capital, Tehran. Upon the fall of Reza Khan and excessive dependence of his son, Mohammad Reza, to the West, especially the US, hundreds of American films were screened. In those days, the US started training of Iranian artists and filmmakers. In 1940s, from among 400 films that were screened in Iran, nearly 300 were American. After the U.S. staged coup d'etat in August 1963, the Iranian cinematic climate turned toward more profiteering and box office. Hence, entertaining films little by little found their way into Iran's cinema. In 1950s and 60s, pornographic films were gradually screened in some of the Iranian cinemas, particularly in Tehran. This corrupt trend continued till the end of the regime's life in Iran in 1979. During this period, the Pahlavi regime made every effort to screen anti-religious and pornographic films in every city, even religious cities like Qom and Mashhad. One of the researchers of cinematic issues categorizes the films of the era of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in four groups. The first group included the films which would clearly ridicule religion. The second group composed the films of which portrayed religious themes like The Deluge and the story of Joseph and Zuleika in a deviated form. The third group was the films which used religion for mundane desires. Finally, the fourth group included few films which contained religious scripts. The Shah regime did its best to mislead young generation so that they would not have the time and motive to even think of the corruption prevailing everywhere in the country. In 1970s, clashes between cinema and religion reached their climax as the cinema had turned into a window for showing the Western corrupt movies. The ulema, led by Imam Khomeini, were strongly opposed to cinema of the Pahlavi regime as it had turned into a tool in the hand of the regime to push forward the American goals in the country. The Imam once said, "If a cinema is ethical and scientific, who will prevent it?" But when we see that our country, from its cinema to its school, is colonialist, it means that these have been brought for us from abroad. They are the gifts that have been brought from there to corrupt our young generation and everything. If a mosque becomes such, we will close it too. The noble prophet demolished the Zarar Mosque. That we are opposed to cinema, it means we are opposed to such a cinema. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, "Radio, TV, the press, cinemas, and theaters have been among effective tools of decadence and numbing of nations, especially the young generation. During the recent century, especially the second half, what big plots were designed with these tools for propagation against Islam and the serving clergy, and for promotion of the Western and Eastern colonialists. They were used for the markets of goods, particularly luxurious and decorative goods of every kind, from imitation in buildings and their decoration and luxury to imitation in drinks and clothing. If, God forbid, the servile and destructive Pahlavi regime had continued, every soon our dear youth would have been corrupt by various devilish conspiracies and schemes of the regime. Or they would have destroyed their youth period in the centers of corruption. Almighty God did a favor to us and them and rescued all from the mischief of the corrupt and the looters." Imam Khomeini, warning the statesman, writes elsewhere in his statement, "Have you forgotten the spread of indecency all over the country and in the centers of corruption, from the brothels to gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a big factor for corrupting the young generation?" Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is?
It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is your host Zainab. I hope wherever you are, you're fine, you're doing well. And in case you have any problems, you're not doing well. In this holy land, we always pray for your well-being, inshallah. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we come up with the issues, the problems, the questions that parents have about the upbringing of their children. Well, the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio with us our guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalafan. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Sister Salma Khalafan, we have a very interesting question today, and I'll start our session with a direct question. We have a parent who asks a question on behalf of his teenager, a 16-year-old, asking, how can you curb the unwishful thoughts and desires that come into your mind while you're living in a Western society where you're exposed to women in provocative clothing?
Yeah, that's a very challenging question also. But of course, as Islam provides all the answers for us in all levels of tarbiyat and all ages of life.
True.
So unfortunately, in our society, youth are constantly bombarded by immorality and corruption everywhere you go and see, you know, billboards, photos, advertisements, even simple programs will kind of provoke a youth if he watches.
Your phone, your internet.
Exactly.
Like, this is something that's very accessible to you all the time.
That's right. So it becomes very difficult for those who want to maintain an ethical religious standard of life to keep up with these values of what? Modesty.
Yeah.
Right? So, of course, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the great, he guides whom he wills. But, you know, here his mashiyat, that is his will, is a wise plan. It doesn't mean that so and so I will out of my own desire. No, whatever Allah wills. No, it's because he sees the wisdom behind it. How? That person himself should will it.
All right.
Because of that free will that he has from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
So another person has to think about changing himself, then Allah will guide that person.
You
right?
are reminding me of a quote I used to see in my school time on the board always, that was written in the bold letters. It was, God helps those who help themselves.
Asad, yes. Also in the Quran, we have some ayats that is just now not, you know, I can't remember them, but they are many ayats to say that Allah
that
helps only
to this, so, those same thing.
Who help themselves. So Allah guides whomever he wills out of his wisdom, of course. So we have to put our trust in him and never despair of his mercy. You know, this youth probably has seen these kind of challenges.
Yeah.
The parent has, put this question forward that my teen has confided in me. And that's a very big thing. If a teen confides to his parents, he trusts his parents. There's a communication, you know, like a relationship of communication between the two, which is a very commendable thing, I feel. So he says he's put this in front of me by saying that this is a great challenge for me. When I'm seeing immodesty in front of me, I'm getting like, you know, I'm falling into sin, right? Yeah. I'm looking at the women and I'm probably committing sins in the process. So Allah says, never despair of my mercy, first of all, okay? And then you think of a plan. Because if you despair of Allah's mercy, you won't go forward. Because this is the thing that shaitan attacks you first with, hopelessness.
Right.
When the hopelessness sets in, he knows that you'll become a passive person. But when the hope comes, then you'll see now that initiative will come. What do I do about it, right?
Yeah.
So, no despair and mercy in Islam. So,
That's why we have every chapter opening with Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim.
Exactly. Asant. So there is a program we can advise this parent to talk to, since the youth has talked to his parent himself. We can advise the youth, the father, to set up a program for him. You know, at these times they're so vulnerable. that they don't know what to do. So you set them up a program.
All right.
That this is what you should do. Number one, number two, number three during the day.
All right.
And that's it really proves very fruitful in the end.
Okay? Yeah.
First of all, keep oneself busy with a specific devotional program of the day.
All right.
What is the specific devotional program? For example, prayers 5 times a day, even some mustahabat, maybe going to visit somebody,
going to the recommendations,
a friend, or going to the mosque to pray, meeting good people of the mosque, listening to their duas and Quran. Make sure that you'd
advise. Visiting the sick, in fact, visiting the sick people in the hospital.
That might be not possible every day.
Yeah.
But keeping this devotional program in such a way that he's able to remain alert and to even account for his deeds at the end.
All right.
And alertness is it's called muraqibah. The muraqibah bit should be advised that if you want improve your spirituality by these devotional acts of muraqibah, being alert.
Being alert. And,
Allah is looking at you. Alam ya'alam bi anna Allah yara. So when you are alert, you will know that these things are forbidden for me. And the more you pray, the more you become godly, the less you become sinful. It's automatic.
All right.
You know, where Allah is there in the heart, shaitan flees.
All right. So you have to actually make a strong connection with Allah, one or the other way, to stay away from this issue.
The sins, exactly. So, and to remain busy, you know, in life. For example, if a person is idle, the idle thoughts is the devil's workshop.
Yeah.
The devil will come in all kind of ways. For example, if he sees this kind of, immodesty in the streets, he'll look for it in the internet as well. He'll say that I want to see more of it.
The curiosity grows.
Yes, exactly. So, and a youth, of course, has everything ready for, you know, like...
Accessible.
Yes, exactly. And falling into this pit.
Yeah.
Because of his desires at its peak, right?
Yeah.
So he wants to do something to let out his desires, but of course, out of Sharia, which is haram. So when he practices this kind of specific devotional program, it'll be very less likely. Another specific devotional program is fasting.
It's
very hard, but encourage the youth. Like the father could encourage him that if you fast once a week, maybe I could give you a, for example, maybe gift him with some money or something.
You
like
have
that,
to encourage your child.
Yeah.
And fasting is something that teaches us to get rid of our nafs, of our self, of our desires. Because a person is captured by his desires. So in order to get rid of that, we need to, we need to fast, and fasting teaches us a lot. I will be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio, and we are talking about Islamic upbringing, a very important issue, how to stay safe from the unwishful thoughts. We have Sister Khalafan with us, and Sister, you were telling us some of the very beautiful devotional ways how to attach ourselves. You said we should go for fasting.
Yes, but sometimes it's very difficult for a youth to fast because maybe he goes to school and he gets tired and he does sports and everything like that. So maybe you could tell him that, you know, to prevent yourself from shaitanic thoughts, first of all, lower your gaze.
Oh.
Yeah. Lowering your gaze is, people would look at it as strange, but it would really attract.
All right.
There would be a lot of light from him, and people would share that. People would try to love him also because of that. He is doing it for what? For the sake of Allah, right? So as soon as this appears near him, he should look down, however much it's hard for him. Because this is the easy way out, right?
Yeah.
If he doesn't look, he won't be exposed to that kind of, you know, illicitness or immodesty. So he won't yearn for it, right? So he has to do that. And another thing is that he can recite zikr also, la hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-ali al-azim. Whenever, you know, this zikr actually takes away the shaitanic thoughts. Actually said, ulama have said, big scholars, great scholars have mentioned that if you want to take away bad thoughts from your mind, la hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-ali al-azim is the best zikr. So could teach him that this should be part of your devotional program during the day, apart from the prayers and, if you can, the fast. Such azkar and lowering your gaze. And then not talking to everyone, you know?
It's not necessary to talk to every person. It's not necessary
to talk to even like a person in the West, a boy. Does he really need to talk to the girls in his class?
Not needed all the time.
Not needed at all. He may talk to boys because their boys and girls are mixed together, right?
Yeah.
In the, for example, in the high school that they go to. So they can easily do that. Not looking at the billboards, lowering the gaze, not looking down that you can fall or something like that, lowering your gaze.
And I think especially this lowering the gaze kind of thing that we also have in Quran when it's the verse of hijab comes in. I think it actually starts with the males first. Lowering your gaze. I think lowering your gaze is the hijab for men. Tell the believer, men and women to, like, first it tells for men to lower their gaze, and I think not all the time a person should be lowering the gaze, but once he gets feeling that way, like he's seeing those unwishful,
he gets distracted
actually, so he has to lower his gaze, he has to actually avoid in one or the other way. So sister, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam said, the best among you is he who learns the Quran and teaches it.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing, and we are talking about very important issue, how to stay safe from unwishful thoughts. So sister, you told us beautiful ways, you told us beautiful things, you told us the devotional programs and a list of things one can do, from fasting to lowering gaze. And other things. I would want you to continue if we have something else pending in the session.
It's very necessary. Exercise program. The youth should be encouraged to play, so much so that at the end of the day he gets so tired that he falls asleep naturally. Rather than having those thoughts all together, you know, filtering.
Yeah.
That what did I see today? Oh, this kind of thing was so attractive for me. And then he keeps on and on, and shaitan lures him to fall into sin and things like that. So that stage should not come about in the first place. Curb it, root it, uproot it before they fall in the pit. Yeah. So just as it starts, it should be uprooted. Otherwise, if it lingers and then you uproot it, it's very hard. It spoiled your kind of your heart, the state of your heart. It's made you feel like desirous. It's caused you to go step by step to the shaitanic plans, you see. But if you uproot it directly, and one way to prevent these thoughts from coming in itself in the first place is to be active, exercise, give a program, sports program for the child. Either whatever he likes, swimming, like tennis, whatever he likes, let him be so, like go to the gym, like work out in the gym for 2 hours. If the father accompanies him, it becomes all the more special for the boy. So both of them can work out in the gym. And then when they come, they're so tired.
Yeah, so and that they fall asleep naturally.
Yes, yes, exactly. And then another thing is that the type of food you give to this boy. Is it junk food? Is it meat kind of food? Meat increases the desires, the shahwa. Yes, so what should the... Always plan the meal, the diet in such a way that...
you give proteins, but... You manage that.
Yes, exactly. Give the diet in such a way that it's all balanced.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank you so much for giving us such beautiful ways. You always come up with such beautiful discussions, and you reminded me today of my father, who gave me in my teens a small diary and told me, while you sleep, make an account of yourself. Make two columns, a good things I did in the day, the bad things, and ask for forgiveness for the bad things, and promise yourself you'll never do that again. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. To listen to that session again, you can go back to our website, parstoday.com, go to Call of Islam. Email us your questions as well at the email englishradio@irib.ir. And in case you want to follow us on the social media platforms, you can just search Call of Islam Radio and you can find programs there. Thank you so much for listening. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Discrimination based on color, race, ethnicity, or religion is repugnant and must not only be condemned but also opposed practically, says Khadija Ali, journalist, in an article titled Islamophobia, the Last Form of Racism in the World. Stay tuned for more. The Discrimination based on color, race, ethnicity, or religion is repugnant and must not only be condemned, but also opposed practically. There are numerous United Nations General Assembly resolutions affirming concrete action against racial or other forms of discrimination. Yet, Islamophobia continues to rage and exacts a heavy toll of innocent Muslims in many parts of the world, including Canada. One particular UNGA resolution proposed that the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination be observed annually. It coincides with the day the white police force in South Africa opened fire and killed 69 blacks in Sharpeville in 1960. They were holding a peaceful demonstration against apartheid passed laws. South Africa was then under apartheid rule. It ended in 1992 and South Africa elected its first black president, Nelson Mandela, in 1994. In 1979, the General Assembly adopted a program of activities to be undertaken during the second half of the decade for action to combat racism and racial discrimination. The UNGA decided that a week of solidarity with the peoples struggling against racism and racial discrimination, beginning on March 21st, would be organized annually in all states. There is even an international convention on the elimination of racial discrimination, but racism in different forms exists. Its most virulent form is Islamophobia, targeting Muslims because of their faith and how they dress. While states have adopted various measures from perfunctory to serious against racial discrimination, Islamophobia continues to grow with deadly consequences. It exists at multiple levels, individual, institutional, and state. Some individuals may harbor prejudices, but it is the state that provides the framework, both through active policies and also lack of policies to confront this menace that leads to its spread. Let us consider the UNGA debate and subsequent adoption of a resolution against Islamophobia on March 15th. Proposed by Pakistan, the resolution was supported by 55 Muslim-majority countries of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, as well as many other countries in North Africa and Russia and China. It affirmed that March 15th will be marked annually as the UN-recognized International Day to Combat Islamophobia. March 15th marks the anniversary of the 2019 attacks on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, in which 51 Muslim worshippers were murdered in cold blood as they gathered for Friday prayers. It has now emerged that the Christchurch terrorist, originally from Australia, was influenced in part by a pro-Israel Canadian media outlet, Rebel Media, whose owner, Ezra Levant, promoted Islamophobic troops. Levant tried to silence, unsuccessfully as it turned out, those that exposed his media outlet's influence on the mass murderer. The Christchurch terrorist was no doubt influenced by other racist outlets and individuals, as well as leading him to commit one of the most despicable crimes against innocent Muslims. The UNGA vote on Islamophobia, while welcomed by OIC Secretary General Hassan Brahim Taha, had its opponents as well. Taha said it would consolidate global awareness of the threat of hatred and fanaticism against Muslims. And who opposed the UN-recognized International Day to Combat Islamophobia? France, the European Union, and India spoke against the resolution, but did not oppose its adoption by consensus. Looking a little deeper, it is not surprising why these three entities spoke against the resolution. While Europe, especially France, Germany and Britain, have led the racists and bigots and have also enacted laws specifically targeting Muslims, India has also come out swinging against its 200 million Muslim citizens. The French representative at the UN, Nicolas Daud-Rivière, took refuge behind the excuse that France supported the protection of all religions and beliefs, but questioned the singling out of a specific religion. He described the resolution as unsatisfying and problematic. What did he fail to explain was, why has the French regime instituted laws that target Muslims only? Further, Paris took the lead in banning the hijab, the Muslim women's head covering. Women can uncover as much as they want, but Muslim women and girls cannot cover. This goes against French secularism, we are told. And what was the Monsieur Daud-Rivière problem with recognizing Islamophobia as a racist ideology? He said, the term Islamophobia has no agreed upon definition in international law, unlike the freedom of religion or conviction. But it's this liberty that France defends, as well as all other public freedoms, such as freedom of expression or conviction. Daud-Rivière need not have indulged in such verbal gymnastics. The regime that he represents is racist to the core. They are unabashedly anti-Muslim. The rest of Europe is little better, as was evident from the opposition of EU representative. The bloc represents 27 European countries, and while it has permanent observer status at the UN, it does not have voting rights. The EU representative said a focus on Islamophobia was an unnecessary duplication after the UN in 2019 adopted August 22nd as an international day commemorating the victims of acts of violence based on religion or belief. The EU's Islamophobic attitude surfaced when its statement said, "We are concerned with the approach of addressing only one religion through a General Assembly initiative." The EU representative could not be oblivious of the fact that, under the rubric of freedom of expression, vulgar cartoons of the Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, have been published in several European countries. Such acts are meant to humiliate Muslims. Freedom of expression has limits. No other religion or its revered personalities are subjected to such vulgar attacks.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.